All right, welcome in. McElroy and Kubelik in the morning. Good to be with you on a Tuesday, October 19th, 7 a.m. right here on Jocks 94.5 as we get rolling. Monday Night Football last night, get into that for just a little bit. We've got more coaching news in college football. Andy Staples going to join us at 7:30. A lot to get into with Andy. Just want to ask him a little bit about the Florida situation, obviously what could be next for LSU, and then, of course, the national championship picture, which just doesn't seem extremely clear right now. We'll spend a little bit of time on that later in the show. And then Will Anderson. Yes, that Will Anderson will join us at 9:30 this morning. And I wanted to start, Greg, just spend a little bit more time on Will Anderson. You went in depth just a little bit yesterday about his performance against Mississippi State and just some of the things that he does. Obviously, there was part of that conversation was Mississippi State moving forward. What are some of the things that they're going to be able to do? Are they going to be able to adapt? If they don't, what they're going to look like? They're not going to face a Will Anderson every week, but still, there was some of what Alabama had success with that was not just him pass rushing in a one-on-one situation. There were some twists that allowed him to get in and be able to get to the backfield. There were some other stunts and pressures that allowed he and his teammates to be able to get into the backfield. So there were some times that because things mechanically weren't working up front, he was able to get into the backfield. There were plenty of one-on-ones that he won also, and we know those tackles are going to be in a tough spot because the distance between the guard, they're not going to be able to get help quickly, and then they're not going to be able to trade some things off as fast as maybe some other teams. But I still continue to be impressed with the overall player that he is because as good of a pass rusher as he is, you see him drop back out in coverage and take away a screen at one point. You see him playing the run and spilling runs left and right. You see him just being able to be a penetrator in some short yardage situations. It's not just, okay, it's third and eight, it's time to tee off. I mean, the guy really is a very well-rounded football player. I don't know if he gets enough credit for that because people just look at, you know, the size, the intangibles, and then the ability to get to the quarterback. But he really, I mean, he leads the nation in tackles for loss. And I think part of that reason is because of how he plays the run and the overall football player that he is.
Well, obviously, last week was a great performance statistically, and he impacts the game. I mean, there's no doubt he impacts the game on every snap, whether it's pass or run. He's one of the more dominant edge presence. Yeah, but I'm describing him as like a.
I mean, this is an English class. This is, you know, we talking ball.
He's one of the most disruptive guys on the edge playing college football. Like, I mean, that's just the best way to describe it. I mean, the guys can get after you from a speed standpoint, he can get after you from a power standpoint. He's got great length. And there's really not a whole lot more that you can ask from him. He's got a great motor. And he holds other players accountable. If you're going to be the guy that challenges everyone else in the locker room, you better go out there and do everything yourself the right way. Well, he's capable enough to be able to challenge and elevate his level of play even to a level that we hadn't seen from him in quite a while. So very, very intriguing to watch him the last few weeks. I do think last year he was kind of just flying around by the seat of his pants, still making plays and doing a lot of great things. But he has now, I think, refined his craft even to a point where he's on another level this year when he's allowed those one-on-one situations. So Mike Leach, his plan, I would say, on Saturday resembled that of Les Miles' plan when he tried to run Leonard Fournette right up the middle. Like, you can't do that. You have to, at some point, acknowledge that the other team is kicking your tail in one specific area, and you have to be able to make adjustments. Mike Leach did not. As a result, Will Anderson teed off, and it led to one of the more productive days we've seen from him in his time in the crimson white jersey. So we'll see what happens as things move forward with Mike Leach, but Will Anderson, regardless of what you do, is going to be a problem throughout the rest of his career.
You know, when I had the Mercer game, I did a little research on the NFL draft as it pertained to Anderson. Now, I know he's not eligible this year, but you think about a guy that's 6'4", 245, having 34-inch arms. Just to give you an idea, Khalil Mack has been sort of the, I guess, overachiever in that department from an elite pass rusher standpoint coming out. He had 33.5-inch arms, which was considered long for that stature, for that kind of a guy. And you know, he was a little bit bigger, 6'3", 267, coming out of Buffalo. But, I mean, Will Anderson's been, he has been clocked at 20 miles per hour on the GPS multiple times. You get that kind of length and a legitimate measurable length, and that's why we did the broomstick analogy in the Southern Miss game. It's that, I mean, those are just extra things that are going to separate him from other guys as far as what he projects to be, what he is, and then potentially what he's going to turn out to be in the NFL. So it's going to be fun to watch. I'm looking forward to talking to him at 9:30 today. Alabama defensive end, outside linebacker Will Anderson will be with us at 9:30. Andy Staples, 7:30. Mississippi State, obviously, some struggles that they're going to have to repair, get around. Mike Leach announcing yesterday that Jack Abraham also is not with the team, so hasn't been something that would be an issue yet. But obviously, depth at that position, you wonder if something did happen to Will Rogers, how would that look? The SEC announcing yesterday a $250,000 penalty for Tennessee due to the actions by fans in the game Saturday night against Ole Miss. That won't be the only thing coming their way, as there will be some other reviews of policies and processes inside the stadium. They're going to first be required to use all available resources, including security, stadium, TV, video, to find the individuals who threw objects. And then if they are identified, they will be prohibited from attending Tennessee athletic events for the remainder of 2021-2022 academic and athletic year. They're going to review and update their athletic department game management procedures and alcohol availability policies. And then completion of that review prior to their next home football game, they're going to have to provide a report to the conference for office summary. So the SEC does come down on Tennessee. Is that about what you expected that the league office would do, the action that they would take against Tennessee for what happened Saturday night?
I think I could have probably written out their statement before it was released. I mean, the 250 feels like that's a pretty standard go-to for something this egregious. It felt, and you knew that they were going to try to say, hey, we're going to try to make the people that were responsible accountable. We're going to definitely evaluate everything. I thought for sure that there would be reference to the alcohol sales in the stadium. The one thing that I would say I was a little surprised by is, you know, we're going to get back to you in a little bit down the road. Once you evaluate all your policies, if there's no changes, that's when we're really going to bring the hammer down. I thought the hammer would be brought down. But I think it's probably the right way to go about it. I mean, how do you penalize something that's somewhat unprecedented? I don't feel like I've ever seen anything quite like this. I've seen stuff thrown on the field, but never to the point where it stops a game for 17 minutes. And I've heard so many people complain about the officiating and we need to make full officials full-time. And people that are sitting here talking about, you know, how bad the officials are. Understandable. There have been questionable calls throughout the course of the season. I get it. By the way, anyone can become an official. Anyone that feels like they can do a better job, please, by all means, sign up. Like, if you think you can do a better job, please do it. The other thing I'd like to see, too, is I'd like for everyone to take a step back and watch officiating outside the SEC. If even the SEC's bad, oh my goodness. You can't even begin to imagine how bad it is in other leagues. Like, this league still does a pretty dang good job. But I won't speak on behalf of some of the other leagues. I literally saw a guy get targeted, them recognize it and not call it, which eventually led to that one particular team winning the game. That was in the Pac-12 a few years ago. I've never seen anything like it. I was dumbfounded. It's the most obvious targeting of all time. I think a lot of people lose their mind about the officiating and all this other stuff, and they want to blame this and want to deflect. I've never heard more whataboutism from Tennessee. It's unbelievable. Oh, well, what about Ole Miss? What about? Knock it off. Accept responsibility. Accept and make sure you have accountability. And let's move on. I don't want to talk about it anymore because it ruins what was a really nice night for Tennessee. And that's, I think, what's most unfortunate.
All right, going back to just kind of everything that surrounded that. Josh Heupel, Tennessee head coach, his thoughts just on that entire experience and how it played out.
Yeah, they're going to take away the 59 minutes, you know what I mean, the slight delay. And then, I mean, to see our student body rush down and fill the bottom part of the section, the remainder of our crowd to be amped up for the final minute of play, like, that's the takeaway. And I know for some people, the story is what happened. Our administration has obviously made it clear that that's not the stance and what we want from the volunteer spirit. you know that I feel the same way. That's a very few number. Man, the passion, energy from our fan base. I've been in a lot of competitive arenas as a player and as a coach. There was nothing better that I've ever been in than what happened on Saturday night.
And I've said it multiple times, multiple places. I actually said it on the broadcast that was the way Nealon was supposed to look for three quarters, let's just say 58 minutes of football. And when they came out of the tee, kind of the new stuff that they're doing with the lights and everything, I mean, it was fantastic. Just Checker Nealon, that many people in there. I think they announced 104, felt a little bit lighter than that, but still it was pretty close to capacity. It was extremely loud. And it was everything that you felt like that place should be and what we've seen it be before. So I have no problem with that being a takeaway because I'll still take that away from it. And I'll remember it partially for that. But I'm not going to completely bypass some of the other stuff that happened because obviously that is going to be a situation that can't continue again. Coach Heupel also just on.
How do you feel about the whataboutism? I saw more people from Tennessee tweet, well, look at Ole Miss threw stuff on the field. Well, what about this? What about this when this happened? They try and deflect as if they bear no responsibility. I'm not saying they do. I'm saying there were probably about 500 bad apples in a crowd of 104,000. But maybe it reflects poorly on everybody.
Yeah, maybe not even 500.
What about is going to help?
But a smaller number, there's zero doubt. It's listen, Greg, I got a couple dudes coming at me on some stuff that happened to me about a decade ago, and they feel like it's relevant to bring that back up and throw that in my face because I said on the broadcast that I wouldn't have my team out there. So I'm right in the middle of that garbage right now. So I know exactly what it is. I know exactly how they're treating it, and it's BS, man. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. So, but hey, if that's, you want to die on that limb of it's only water bottles, it's only beer cans. That's
until,
I mean,
yeah, like, cool. Until they hit somebody and,
no, you know, why don't you go fine. Stand down there and let right, Joe Milton throw a water bottle at you. Tell me how that feels.
Exactly.
I'm not sure I'd let Joe Milton throw a Nerf ball at me. Take it. That's, I mean,
it's the same thing. It's no different than Twitter tough guys, man. It's literally no different. Everyone's a tough guy. The players can't get me up here.
Right, exactly. You know? Exactly.
Right. It's no different. That's just society where we're at right now. It's unfortunate. And it takes away. Hey, Tennessee's fan base is the one that's constantly made mistakes over the last several years. Not us. Not us that have basically said they're hurting their program. They are.
Yeah.
Coaching hires, other boycott Nealon. Tennessee fans have hurt their program. I don't know how else to tell you. I'm not saying they don't support their program. I'm not saying they don't love their program, but they've heard it in the last decade. And I'm not saying they shouldn't be frustrated. I want you to be frustrated because I want you to get back to the top. But you got to bear some responsibility. And last Saturday, another good example of Tennessee fans having a real bad look for their football team. There were recruits in the stands. And I guarantee you, if I were a recruit in that stands, and my mom saw that, you know what she'd say?
You're not going here,
You're bro. Not going to Tennessee.
Because they low down, they dirty, they some snitches.
No, I'm telling you, my mom would have said, there is no way in hell you're going here.
Not a chance.
And if you do, I'm not coming. I'm, that's what my mom would have said. But and I hope that didn't happen for any of those recruits that were up there. I hope that didn't happen for Tennessee. But I bet you it did. I'd be surprised if it didn't.
I just got a text that said I wouldn't worry about Milton throwing anything at me. It'd go way over my head.
Wow. That's a good point.
Low-hanging fruit.
You'll feel the smoke coming off of
it. Fair. Yeah.
Dodged out.
However, when that page is turned, some people will do it sooner than others. Alabama is in the windshield. And Josh Heupel discussed his quarterback situation yesterday heading into that game.
Yeah, Hendon and Tyon and Kate are probably, day-to-day at this point. We'll see as the week unfolds where we end up with Hendon. And I don't think it's a long-term injury. His status for this week, we'll find out as we go.
Great news just that it's not long-term. That first and foremost because it did not look good when it happened. And he was really building towards being able to put together a special season. Some of the things that he was able to bring to that offense was totally different when he was inserted. And like I said yesterday on the show, Coach Golish and Coach Heupel both just wanted to emphasize to us when we met with them, say, listen, there was one thing that we didn't know about him, and that was how tough he was. And then when he got in the game, we were able to learn that because we had to run him, and that was going to be a part of this offense because I think they know they're a little bit limited with what they can normally do through the air. And also, they didn't have a lot of that at Central Florida, and they wanted to add it. But then he proved how tough he was and what he was able to deal with and handle and carry, and all of a sudden he changed what that offense was. So I want to see him back playing college football this year because I think he's a cool story. We didn't get to it, but you know, there's apparently a poem out there when he was at Virginia Tech that he wrote to himself, only he and his mom have seen, and just kind of to help motivate himself. Then getting, you know, coming to Tennessee, thinking you got the job, getting benched, then getting it back. Like I love a story like that for a guy to come back and be successful. So I hope we see him again this year. It feels doubtful that you'll see him this weekend, and obviously that's not great for Tennessee. Josh Heupel does know what's ahead, though, in this matchup.
Huge opponent, really good football team, rivalry game, one that our guys and staff will be extremely excited about being ready for and going down to Tuscaloosa and competing against a really good football team. Starts with the quarterback, super efficient playmaker as well. He's got dynamic playmakers around him defensively, obviously front to back. Really good, athletic, have the ability to rush the passer, can do that with pressures, can do that with just their front four, and got good cover guys on the back end. So big test for us, one that we're excited about, though.
So obviously not a matchup that I think we're going to look at and say multiple areas favor Tennessee in that game. We'll get to it a little bit more later in the week. But Tennessee kind of banged up. I mean, they're down a D tackle. Tyon Evans was going to be a game-time decision. I think they let him give it a try early in warm-ups and then realized that that just wasn't going to happen. Now you got a little bit of a quarterback situation as well. I know you had one out on the back end, so Tennessee trying to get some of those guys back as they're going to go face off against Alabama this weekend and see how that one plays out because Alabama looks like they kind of turned the corner. I mean, defensively, that was a very unique offense, but is there a lot of carryover from the air raid to this outside of the tempo? Leach's not going real fast this year with that group. We know Tennessee is going to want to go fast regardless of who plays quarterback, but can you see some of the things that Pete Golding did, that the individuals did, and translate it to what it's going to look like against Tennessee, Greg?
Yeah, and depending on what Tennessee wants to be formationally, you're not going to have as many open edges, and their one, I guess, cloak of protection is going to be backs chipping out. No, I mean, they're going to be a little more multiple, and they're going to mix some tempos. The biggest thing is Joe Milton, can he be effective? If Hendon Hooker can't go, can the quarterback run game be as effective with Joe Milton? I know they used him, especially against Pitt. He had that one big run down the left sideline, so it's not as though he's a stick in the mud. He can move, but he's not nearly the runner that Hendon Hooker was. But let's go back to the original point. Joe Milton won this job in camp. Now, Hendon Hooker has obviously brought stability to the position and has been really good for Tennessee the last few weeks. Big reason why people are feeling real positive about where Tennessee's going. Joe Milton won the job in fall camp. He must have done something right. I'm not sure what it was, but he must have done something right. So this guy is still capable. I'm not sure he's as accurate as
46.7% on the year.
Well, I'm not sure he's as accurate as Zach Calzada is. You know what I'm saying? Like Zach Calzada at Texas A&M is pretty streaky, but when he's on, he's on. Joe Milton might be the same way. And I don't want to find out if I'm Alabama this weekend. I think Joe Milton is going to struggle. I absolutely do. I think he's going to struggle. And especially if Will Anderson, those guys are teeing off. Because Cole, I don't know about you. I'm not thrilled if I'm Tennessee and I'm seeing that defensive line. I don't love the matchup that I have with my tackles working against that guy, number 31.
Well, if Cade Mays is not playing, which you lost him in that game also, and I know Cooper Mays at center was going to give it a go in warmups, and then I think it was determined that he just wasn't ready. And I think the thing about Cooper Mays when he's in is I don't think that there's a massive jump at the center position, but you allowed your normal left guard to get back to where he should be, and that is a major upgrade rather than Ollie being in the game. So when you upgrade that, I think it's better all the way around. But Cade Mays is your best offensive lineman. And if you're down Cade, then I mean, 66 struggled a little bit, especially early in that game. Got beat a couple times around the edge. That's that. Now look who you're facing. Alabama brings a little more than Ole Miss up front. I mean, yeah. Ole Miss has got one that can get you off the edge, not like the one Alabama has, and then not like the others as well. Here's the thing that I'd be excited about, Greg, if I was an Alabama fan heading into this game, is what I liked about Pete Golding's plan against Mississippi State. And you talked about going into that game, and we both talked about it with Ole Miss and Tennessee going into their game. A lot of the reason they've been having success running the football is essentially just taking what's there and not being stubborn and not being hard-headed. And I asked Jeff Lebby on the field before the game, I said, your success on the ground, I said, just be real with me. How much is it of just saying, if they're going to play three down, four or five in the box, we're going to run it? He said, that's absolutely it. He said, we have just decided that if it's there, we're going to take it. We're not playing. You see the amount of times that Matt Corral, and I'd love to get your thought on this, Greg, from a quarterback's perspective, gave you that hard, it's not even a pump fake. It's basically just stopping himself from throwing the football. And we asked him about the turnovers from a year ago, and he did have the one interception, but it was a tip ball. Jordan kind of thought he pressed on that play, but I just thought he's rolling out trying to make a throw. I didn't think he was necessarily taking a high risk there. But we asked him about the six interception game against Arkansas, and a couple of things were interesting. Number one, he said, we had never worked rush three, drop eight against our regular offense. We had not worked it at that point. I did not know what I was seeing. I did not know what it was. Lane would follow up and tell us, we worked how to beat rush three, drop eight the entire offseason. All year we worked it, the entire offseason. And I asked Matt Corral, I said, well, why have those instances not happened this year? And he said, well, it happened twice last year, and I learned my lesson. I'm not going to do it again. So I think when you see him, whether you want to call it a hard pump, whether you want to call it stopping himself, essentially wind up but no delivery, pulling the ball down. To me, Greg, that shows where he's learned, I don't need to take that chance. I don't need to take that risk. I'm not going to try to squeeze that ball in because it could be detrimental to my team. To me, that shows a lot of growth, and that's pretty cool to see a guy as talented as he is that had the year he had last year allow that to carry over as an improvement into this year.
Well, he's also seeing it every day in practice. That helps too because they've gone rush three, drop eight. That's their defensive philosophy. A lot of the time.
Studied Iowa State in the offseason.
So he sees it every day in practice. A little bit more accustomed to pulling it down and not taking the risk and the reward. He's the leader front runner for the Heisman right now. So according to Vegas, so he's in a pretty good spot. One thing I would say is he doesn't have that many showcase games left. So what few he does have, he better ball out. And I don't know if it matters. If Bryce Young goes out and dominates Georgia, I'm not sure it's going to matter. But we'll see. We will see. One thing I don't want to see is water in my crawl space or basement because I don't like the idea of it entering through cracks and mortar joints, up through the cracks in the floors, over and under the footing, and by sweating the walls. I'm Greg Mack, where I'm here for Be Dry because I want to stand by a solution that will permanently solve my waterproofing needs, and that's Be Dry. 60 years of trusted waterproofing foundation repair. You can get peace of mind by choosing a basement crawl space waterproofing and foundation repair company whose solutions are backed by the strongest lifetime warranty in the industry. Thousands of Alabamians have trusted Be Dry for waterproofing and foundation repair needs for over 60 years. Call Be Dry today so they can develop a solution that will permanently solve your issues without unnecessary add-ons. Let Be Dry Waterproofing, dedicated to your satisfaction. Check them out at BeDryAlabama.com or give them a shout at 942-1976. That's 942-1976.
Quickly, just kind of wrapping up what I was saying about the Alabama defense and Pete Golding against Mississippi State. What would make me most happy, Greg, is they were able to go play a little bit heavier in the box and utilize that to be different in the box. So if they wanted to apply more pressure with more guys, they could. If they wanted to run more stunts and have more bodies to be able to do that, they could. And if they wanted to drop guys at different times in different areas, they could also do that. It wasn't just we're only going to rush three. You're going to be able to tee off on our nose, and you'll be able to get help out to your tackles. I mean, it was not that going into this game. So what Tennessee will do is they'll widen you out even more. They're going to get those wide receivers all the way out to the sidelines. And Pete Golding, I think, showed in that game a little bit against State that we can still have numbers in the box and find ways to beat you and find ways to take advantage of you and be okay on the back end, which Alabama obviously was against Mississippi State. So there's some carryover there. My opinion is just the aggressive nature that he'll utilize and play. And you think about that Alabama defense, as down as people are on it, and as much as people don't like it, Miami, lowest output of the season, 266 yards. Florida, second lowest output of the season for them, 439. Ole Miss, lowest output of the season at 291. And Mississippi State, lowest output of the season at 299. Numbers don't lie. We'll talk to Andy Staples about the numbers and the number of candidates that will be available for the LSU job next on McElroy and Kublik in the morning. Welcome back in. McElroy and Kublik in the morning at 7:31 a.m. WJOX 94.5. Tuesday, October 19th. You can listen online, jocksfm.com. Find the podcasts at jocksfm.com, but also Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get yours. I get mine at Apple Podcasts, and the reason I say that is my routine coming home from my games each and every week, whether it's the somehow, someway, six-hour drive from Knoxville Sunday, which should have only been four, whether it's flying, connecting through Atlanta, whatever it is, I load up the Andy Staples podcast every Sunday morning.
Wow.
And you should too, because it is the absolute best at just going right back over a day of college football that just take place, and sometimes actually happening while college football is taking place, like this week, Andy, when I heard you kind of had to stop your discussion because of actually what was going on in Knoxville with the Tennessee-Ole Miss game. I want to start there and just get your thoughts on everything that took place Saturday night at Neyland Stadium with Lane Kiffin, with Josh Heupel, with Tennessee, with Ole Miss, with the fans. What did you come away from that game thinking after you were able to take it all in?
Well, Cole, first I need to ask you, how did we do? You were on the field. I was trying to – because we were just talking about the Florida situation, and I look up and I see cops on the field talking to Lane Kiffin and Josh Heupel. I'm like, what the hell just happened? And so, everything had to stop, and I can't even imagine what it was like down there on the field. But, yeah, I think this is a case where Tennessee fans – and look, it's a very small group of Tennessee fans that was throwing stuff. They should not be throwing stuff. Don't do it. I know it's largely the student section. Just don't do it, because – they're going to do stuff like – I know in England I don't know if it was England, but in Europe they had issues with soccer fans throwing stuff, and they just cleared the stadium and said, we're going to play without fans. Don't make them even think about that. It's not that big of a deal. Look, you think you got screwed on a call, congratulations. You're like every other fan base on it. They all think they got screwed on a call, but they don't all throw stuff. So don't throw stuff. It's pretty simple. But as far as Tennessee goes, I think Tennessee fans should be ecstatic with the way this season has gone. Because think about everything that happened in the offseason. Everything that went down, from the firing of Jeremy Pruitt to everybody leaving. I mean, this is a much better season than you could have possibly hoped for, given the circumstances. And it also should tell you the future could be bright. I mean, I know a lot of people weren't excited about Josh Heupel as a hire, but find me something he's done wrong here. It looks like he's done everything right since he's gotten there, except maybe starting Joe Milton over Hinton Hooker. But they did fix that, and unfortunately, you know, you saw Hooker get hurt at the end of the game.
Well, you lost a game partly because Joe Milton missed, five or six throws against Pitt, so it did cost him a game. I think Heupel's done a great job at just steadying the ship. But what could have been a great positive night for Tennessee ended in disappointment, and that's all anyone was talking about after the game. So not ideal if you are the Tennessee Volunteers. I feel like the fan base can't help themselves. They continue to shoot their program in the foot when two steps forward, one step back. I'm hoping, really, really, really hoping that they stop doing that, whether it's boycott Neyland, whether it's, you know, the Shiano situation, whether it's this situation on Saturday night. It's a bad look, and I think it probably had a negative impact on the recruiting, especially for those recruits that were in attendance. The other things that are going on, though, LSU, I do want to get you on LSU. I think I'm about to lose it if I look at one more writer's opinion about this job opening. It's the same cast of characters every single time. Luke Fickell. I'm so over it. Like, can we get some creativity?
I don't think Luke Fickell would take the LSU job, and I'm not sure that's who they're going after, but yeah.
Well, you know what I'm saying, though. It's the same guy. Like, every job opens, oh, well, who's the best candidates for USC? Matt Campbell, Luke Fickell. It's like all the same people every single time. Can we get some creativity when it comes to this opening here at LSU?
Well, just knowing Scott Woodward, Greg, I think we know he's going to go elephant hunting first. You know, he's gonna try to take some big swings. Like Bruce Feldman, who I work with at The Athletic, he reported yesterday that maybe he takes a swing at Dabo Swinney. I wouldn't be shocked if he did call and make Dabo's agents, you know, Dabo through his agents say no. I wouldn't be shocked if he called about Lincoln Riley and make him say no. There's no reason not to try. And I know that's how Scott Woodward feels about this stuff because I've talked to him about it. When he was at Texas A&M and he hired Jimbo Fisher, he told me the story about hiring at Washington. Steve Sarkisian goes to USC, and he's looking at a bunch of different candidates. And I think Jim Mora was probably the front runner for the job if he was willing to leave UCLA for it because he's from Seattle. And so that was probably the direction they were going to go. And then out of the blue, he gets a call from Chris Peterson's agent. And it's, would you guys be interested in Chris Peterson? And he's like, wait, well, of course we would. And then stops the search, says, whatever we got to do, we're signing Chris Peterson. And from that point forward, he said he was never going to assume somebody was off the board because why not? He didn't know Chris Peterson was even interested. And he was kicking himself for not thinking about that first, but he was glad he got him. So that really was the genesis of how Scott Woodward wound up hiring Jimbo Fisher, who – you know, we know now about the problems at Florida State, but at the time all this was going on, you know, the thought was, well, he's won a national title there. They're going to eventually give him what he wants, and he'll wind up staying. So I would not be shocked if he does go for some big dogs first and make them say no. Now, let's say they do. Listen, I know James Franklin's name has come up. There's a reason for that. You can win national titles at Penn State at Penn State if you can get past Ohio State. You can win national titles at LSU, even if Nick Saban's at Alabama. Ed Orgeron showed you that 2 years ago. So that's a little bit different. But there's also the USC job that I think he would be a good fit for. So that's why his name comes up, because he can recruit the way that you need to recruit. He can coach them on the field the way you need to coach them on the field. But that makes sense. The one name that is going to be hot this carousel, and he's in a weird situation because he's only in second year. He had to leave his first job after 1 year because they made him an offer he couldn't refuse, is Mel Tucker at Michigan State, because he's done an amazing job there. He worked at LSU, and the LSU connection's a little tenuous. He worked there for Nick Saban on Nick Saban's first staff there, but it's not like he has roots there. He's a Midwestern guy, and he's a lot closer to home at Michigan State than he would be to LSU. But what he's done in East Lansing is pretty remarkable considering the roster he inherited. At LSU, whoever comes in is inheriting a roster that's ready to win right now.
Andy Staples of The Athletic joining us on the Bud Light Hotline. So we all agree that it's one of the best jobs in the country and that you're much more capable of winning a national championship at LSU than a lot of other places. But I'm interested in, since you brought that name up, what direction as far as the kind of individual? We know that both of these schools, USC and LSU, are going to be able to get a top-notch coach. But what kind of individual do you think either of those jobs needs and wants? Because we saw both Mississippi schools move out of situations that I personally didn't think were as bad as a lot of the fan bases did and a lot of casual observers did, because they wanted headlines. They wanted billboards. They wanted retweets, likes. They wanted their name in lights. And that's essentially what they both got. Now, the satisfaction of what they got, maybe yet to be determined. I think it's probably looking a little bit better in Oxford right now than it is in Starkville. So from just that perspective, does it matter? And if so, what direction do you see either or both of those schools going?
I think you have to sell a little harder at USC. There's, for a couple of reasons. You know, when Pete Carroll got there, he understood that you're competing against the Lakers and the Dodgers for people's time. And now you're competing also against the Rams and the Chargers, who are both good, by the way, for people's time. And that's not an issue at LSU. So you got to be a little more of a salesman at USC. The other piece of why you got to be more of a salesman at USC is all those kids on the West Coast, If they're staying on the West Coast right now, they're going to Oregon. So you have to convince them why they shouldn't go to Oregon. If they're not staying on the West Coast, and that's a lot of them, they're going to Alabama, they're going to Clemson, they're going to Ohio State. You have to convince them why they should stay where they are. And so I think it'll take a better salesman for that one. LSU doesn't need a salesman. LSU sells itself. You got the three national title trophies this century. That's all you got to show them. Here's all the LSU players that have gone to the NFL over three different head coaches in this century. It does not matter who's in this chair. You're going to go to the NFL and have a chance to win championships at LSU. So that part, the coach does not have to be as big of a salesman, especially in terms of fan attention. The fan attention is always going to be there. So it's more about ball. It's more about, can this person identify the right kind of players? Because you're gonna have your pick of players. It's how well can you choose the ones that fit what you do? And I think that's the part that LSU's got to be very careful about. Because what you saw the last couple of years with LSU is a lack of an identity. If Ed Orgeron knew what the identity of his program was coming off that national championship, then he would have been able to hire assistant coaches to continue that identity. But I don't know that they, because it happened so fast and all came together so well so quickly, I'm not sure they realized all the things that made it go well and so had a hard time hiring to that. They need someone who already knows what their program identity is and can recruit to that.
Have you been around Mel Tucker? Just out of curiosity.
Yes.
What are your thoughts?
I think he is great at motivating players. I think he has a very good plan about what kind of team you want. I mean, he's very much in the Nick Saban, Kirby Smart mold of, you know, corner. Greg, you know the critical factors. You know how they work. A corner's got to be 6 foot to 6'2". He's got to have loose hips. He's got to do, you know, there's a whole list of,
right,
of different
check boxes
that they want.
Yes.
And he is going to do that. If you look at the roster he's trying to put together at Michigan State, he's doing that now. And that is very important to him. You talk to him about other teams. As he scouts other teams that they're going to play, he will refer to them in those terms. He's looking at body types. He's looking at how everything fits together in the puzzle. I know him pretty well because I wrote a book with a guy named Trevor Moad, who was a mental conditioning coach. He worked with Jimbo Fisher at Florida State. He worked with Saban at Alabama. You know him, Greg.
Yep.
And he worked with Kirby at Georgia, and that's where. So Mel got to know him in Alabama and then again at Georgia and took a lot of the stuff to Michigan State. So he's been teaching this book I helped write to his players. And so Mel and I talked quite a bit because Trevor and I wrote a second book, and unfortunately Trevor passed away in September from cancer. But Mel and I talked a lot about all this stuff in the spring as Trevor and I worked on the second book. So he's an interesting one because – you know, I didn't know a ton about him when he went from Georgia to Colorado. I was impressed, by the way. Like, remember when Colorado played Nebraska, and the thought was, okay, Nebraska's gonna roll over these guys. I think it was Scott Frost's second game, and Mel just, you know, handled them. And so, I think you've got a guy who is bound for success if he stays at Michigan State. But I think other schools are going to see why he's going to be successful, and there's going to be interest there. Now, the question is, would he do it? Because he did not want to leave Colorado after a year. He did not like the look of that. He was not happy to have to do that. But when Michigan State offers double your salary and double your assistant pool, there's really not – I mean, you're crazy to say no. And I don't know that the next type of – even if it's LSU, USC, something, a job like that, I don't know that that's going to happen because Michigan State's in the Big Ten. They can pay. So it's really, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with him because I do think there are going to be some schools that sniff around, especially depending on what other jobs come open. Because, guys, this is crazy. You know, it's mid-October. USC, LSU, and Washington State are open. Nebraska may open. If James Franklin takes something else, Penn State could open. I mean, even the backfilling of the jobs could be crazy. Virginia Tech may open. There's a lot of action that could be happening here in the next few months.
Wild stuff, Andy. Appreciate the time. I'm going to ask you one question. I want a yes or no answer before we go to break. Is Cincinnati's trip to the potential college football playoff still at the mercy of Power 5 schools?
No, it's at the mercy of Notre Dame. They got to keep
there you
winning.
Go. Okay.
That'll protect them.
I like it. And great stuff. Always appreciate the time. Look forward to catching up again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Andy Staples of The Athletic. Follow him on Twitter at @Andy_Staples. Find his podcast, Apple Podcasts. Get it every Sunday to catch up on everything that happened on college football the day before. And you join us in the Bud Light Hotline, carefully brewed with a clean, crisp taste. When there's fun, Bud Light is there. We'll discuss that question about Cincinnati next on McElroy and Kubik in the Morning. Welcome back in. McElroy and Kubik in the Morning, 7:51 a.m. Tuesday, October 19th, AP Top 25 out Sunday. Didn't really get to it yesterday. Georgia gets all 63 first-place votes. Cincinnati is now at number two, highest ranking in school history. They're 6-0. Oklahoma 7-0 in at 3. Bama 6-1 at 4. Ohio State 5-1 comes in at 5. Rest of the top 10, Michigan, Penn State, Oklahoma State, Michigan State, and Oregon. So Cincinnati sits there at 6-0. Looking for a potential trip into the college football playoff. But as Andy Staples just said, may not be up to other Power 5 teams. I think there's a reason that it might be. We'll get to that in just a moment.
It's a great thing when the Southeast's largest GMC dealer is also GMC's dealer of the year. Some dealers claim to be number one, but out of the more than 1,800 GMC dealers, General Motors says Bill Smith is number one. That's right. Other dealers claim to be number one at something, but GM says Alabama's only number one dealer is Bill Smith Buick GMC. Right there on Highway 31 in Coleman, you can shop online at BillSmithBuickGMC.com. They'll deliver right to your driveway. Like a brand new 2021 GMC Sierra 1500 four-wheel drive crew cab SLT loaded with options. 6.2-liter Ecotec V8. List price, $60,620. Get it at Bill Smith, $54,997. That's how you stay atop the industry for 65 years. They're family owned. They're locally owned. So go see Andy and Jonathan. Those are my guys. 75% of their business is repeat customers. That's because it's a superior customer experience when you shop at Bill Smith Buick GMC right there on Highway 31 in Coleman, or you can see them at BillSmithBuickGMC.com.
All right, so I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Andy Staples. Do you believe number two Cincinnati right now in the AP poll?
No.
Is their fate controlled by the Power Five, essentially?
Yes. They don't control their own destiny. And it's not anything that Cincinnati can do. It's not their fault. Their schedule weakens. They are completely dependent on what happens with not just Notre Dame, but Indiana. If Notre Dame's wheels fall off and they look kind of like an average team, guess what? The feather in their cap that was once beautiful is no longer pretty. So when you look at Cincinnati, they are completely at the mercy of what happens in the SEC championship game as of right now. Because if Bama beats Georgia, SEC's taken two. And then take it one step further. You got Oklahoma, who currently is undefeated. They need two losses. Find me two. Not with Caleb Williams, a quarterback, at least not right now, the way they're playing. Last weekend was a really nice performance against a solid TCU team. And then Ohio State. Or anyone, by the way, from the Big Ten. Is it likely that the Big Ten champion has two losses? Yeah, that's possible. Very possible. But in the event in which the Big Ten champ has one loss, Cole, that one loss champ will get in over Cincinnati.
I mean, and you and I don't really buy them right now, but Oklahoma State's still sitting there at eight. And that's going to be a resume boost for Oklahoma. Or, I mean, if Oklahoma would Oklahoma State would have to beat Oklahoma twice.
Not going to happen.
Not twice to win it, but they could lose and then win Big 12 title game. So if they split, that probably not the scenario that Cincinnati wants either, because then you technically have two teams to choose from. Don't even discount the entire Big Ten East. I mean, Michigan State, Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State all still have to play. And could you be looking at a similar scenario to what the SEC has there? It's interesting when you look forward and you kind of project out Cincinnati into the playoff. Is it essentially going to be controlled by the rest of the Power Five and what happens there? Or can they just win out and be in? How much help do they need? Dave, I see you on hold. We'll take other calls on Cincinnati. 800-239-9569 when we come back on McElroy and Kubik in the Morning.